Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson.
Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks so much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. This news has been out for a couple of weeks, but in light of my guest today, I want to address the recent item out of England that for the first time, the most popular baby name for boys in the UK, according to their Office for National Statistics, is Mohammed. Mohammed is the most favored boy's name in 4 out of 10 regions in England and Wales, largely in the North and West Midlands, to be precise, as well as in London itself. The key factor behind its rising popularity is, of course, the same mass immigration that has transformed much of continental Europe, especially France, which has the highest Muslim population in Europe, last time I checked. The Muslim population in England and Wales has more than doubled since 2001. The Muslim population stood at 1.5 million in 2001. It increased to 2.7 million by 2011, during which time it grew about 10 times faster than the non-Muslim population, and then it further rose to 3.9 million in 2021. Again, this is all according to the UK's Office for National Statistics. So what, the multiculturalists might say. What's wrong with the Muslim population growing, you bigot? Well, the reason is, when you import massive numbers of people from non-Western cultures and they don't assimilate into a melting pot like we tend to do here in America, then those masses of migrants begin changing the culture. And that's good news for the multiculturalists because they want to see Western civilization eradicated. But here are some sobering facts for the rest of us to consider. A survey carried out in 2024, that's this year, reported that 32% of British Muslims support Islam to be declared the national religion of England. 32% of British Muslims want to make Sharia law the law of the land in the UK. 52% want to make it illegal to show a picture of Muhammad. That means they want blasphemy laws established. 46% believe Jews have too much power over UK government policy, and 46% sympathize more with the terror group Hamas compared to 3% sympathizing more with Israel. 3%. 36% of British Muslims have a positive view of the terror group Hamas. 21% have a positive view of jihad, and we're talking about the kind of jihad that means war against the infidels. And that's just the percentage of people who are willing to admit these things openly. That's why it matters that Europe is being Islamized, and the UK's most popular name for boys is Mohammed. And there's probably no brain better to pick about this topic than that of my upcoming guest, whom I'm proud to call a friend and colleague. I'm excited to have him on, albeit a little frustrated that I know we won't be able to cover everything I'd like to get into with him, but I can guarantee you won't be disappointed, and I'll just have to have him on again. So stay tuned, you don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we are having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at The Right Take is an astoundingly accomplished author and scholar and thinker. He's a Shulman Fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's the director of the essential website jihadwatch.com. He's the author of nearly 30 books, ranging from political commentary to history to theology to biography. And while he's pumping those out, he is also putting out daily commentary at Front Page Mag and PJ Media. He's a true scholar and a gentleman, to which I can personally attest. Robert Spencer, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Well, thanks, Mark. That's a very generous introduction, and I appreciate it. It's an honor for me to be on the show.
I am honored to have you here. And that was actually a pretty modest introduction. You've got a lot of achievements under your belt, an incredible amount of writing and scholarly output. So thanks for coming on. I know that you are capable of talking about a wide range of issues, both past and present, and maybe toward the end of our time together, we could talk about whatever you feel compelled to comment on about current events, because there's obviously a lot going on. But mostly, I want to give you a chance to talk about your latest book, Muhammad, A Critical Biography, because I think it has the potential to really shake things up in terms of our ongoing conflict with Islam, our clash of civilizations, if you will. And as a prologue to diving into the book, I want to get your take on a related news item out of England that the most popular baby name for boys in the UK is Muhammad. What does that suggest to you?
Well, Mark, very simply, what people don't realize is that this is not just a change in fashion like the change from John to William or William to Michael or whatever that might have happened in the past for the most popular baby name in Britain. This heralds a massive cultural and societal transformation such that Britain has not experienced since the Norman conquest in 1066. It is now well underway, and yet most people have no idea that it's happening. They have no idea of the significance of mass Muslim migration into the country because it's forbidden, essentially, in Britain to speak honestly about the teachings of Islam that require political conquest and the subjugation of the native population. Now, Britain's going to find out that those teachings exist, and it's going to find out pretty quickly. But right now, all we have are the harbingers of what is to come, which this name business is one of them, one of the foremost. The fact is that within another generation or two, there are going to be very few other names in Britain. And once again, this is something that the British people and the West in general just has no idea of what's coming.
Well, along those lines, many conservatives are pretty pessimistic about the future of Europe. They say demography is destiny, it's too late for France and the UK, and so on. Do you think that in the wake of this transformation of Europe through mass migration, that the Europe we once knew, the old world that we once knew and loved, is irretrievable?
Well, you know, nothing is impossible. The record of history is full of surprises, but I don't think that the world as we knew it, even the Britain of the 70s and 80s, is retrievable, because what even if Britain manages to stave off Islamization, even if tomorrow Reform UK comes into power and starts mass deportations of illegals and starts even challenging the Muslim community to show real fidelity to the state as it is currently established, rather than trying to bring Sharia to Britain. Even if all that were to happen, you've still got this massive and quickly growing Muslim population, and they're not going to go away. They were born there. They are British citizens, so there's no deporting them. And the government certainly is not going to enter into some kind of general confrontation with them and risk a civil war. And so I think that at this point, you could only get a postponement of the Islamization and not an outright staving it off. I hope I'm wrong, and we'll see.
And it's a Muslim population that, to a large extent anyway, has no intention of assimilating into a sort of a melting pot like we have here. In my opening remarks, which you have not heard, but in my opening remarks to this podcast, I mentioned a survey that was carried out just this year, which reported that 32% of British Muslims support Islam to be declared the national religion. And 32% of British Muslims also want to make Sharia law the law of the land in the UK. 52% want to make it illegal to show a picture of Muhammad, which means that they essentially want blasphemy laws established. And I think they already, to some extent, have de facto blasphemy laws, because you can literally be arrested for tweeting something that is considered offensive to Muslims. So the Islamization of the UK is pretty far along, apparently, at this point.
Yeah. And you know, Mark, they fell victim to their own fantasies, because I remember after 9/11, we were hearing from Tony Blair that he was reading the Quran and it was wonderful. And they set up the PREVENT program, which is still Britain's counterterror program, but it is very clearly oriented according to the fantasy that Islam is a religion of peace. It has nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. and those Muslims who turn to terrorism simply misunderstand their own faith. And if they can be properly instructed in their faith, then everything will be okay. That is still the core assumption of the British government. And on that basis, it's been shown many times that Prevent has taken somebody to be a harmless, moderate Muslim, and they turned out to be a convinced and active jihadi. And this has happened more than once. And it's because of the British government's refusal to face the reality of what Islam really is and what it teaches. Because, of course, that would show up the British government under a whole succession of prime ministers now to have been following what is essentially a suicidal immigration policy that threatens the core of British civilization itself. And so they're not going to dare to be that self-incriminating. They have to keep on perpetuating these fantasies. But as time goes by, as the survey results that you quoted indicate, the fact that they have been at war with reality becomes harder and harder to deny.
You mentioned a jihadi a moment ago, and since you did mention that, this is going to sound like a very basic question for those like me who keep up with Jihad Watch and your books, but it's easy for the average well-meaning but ignorant person to be confused by Islamic apologists who downplay jihad as fighting against the infidel because they point out that that's only the lesser jihad, and the greater jihad is the struggle within oneself. So how do you respond to people who try to muddy the waters about what jihad has been historically and how the devout have always viewed it, even today?
Mark, this business about the greater jihad and the lesser jihad is one of the biggest scams that Islamic apologists and their leftist allies have pulled over on the British government and the Western world in general since 9/11. The fact is, and there are numerous Islamic scholars who will tell you this, you don't have to get it from the wicked Islamophobe Spencer, but since I'm here, I'll tell you, and you can check it. The greater jihad is based on what is known as a weak hadith. A weak hadith is a report on the words and deeds of Muhammad that is considered to be inauthentic by Islamic scholars and thus inadmissible for Islamic doctrine. And the fact is that the hadith sources that are most reliable in the view of Islamic scholars do not contain that story. It is only found in a collection that is not considered to be all that reliable. And so the Islamic apologists after 9/11, they seized upon this story of Muhammad leaving a battle and saying, we are now leaving the lesser jihad and going to the greater jihad. And they disseminated it all over the Western world as evidence that Islam is fundamentally peaceful and only resorts to warfare in a defensive mode. When in the first place, this story is not even considered authentic by Islamic scholars. And in the second place, even if you call the lesser jihad, if you call warfare in the name of Islam in order to advance Islamic hegemony the lesser jihad, it is still very much a part of Islamic doctrine. The Quran itself says, fight them until persecution is no more and religion is all for Allah. That's chapter 8, verse 41. I mean, 8, verse 39. So if you're going to fight until persecution is no more, that sounds like you're just defending yourself. But then it goes on, and religion is all for Allah. Mark, if your religion is not all for Allah and you're just minding your own business, then there are some Muslims out there who will come ultimately to think that they have an obligation to fight you. That is offensive jihad. You don't have to do anything to them except your religion is not all for Allah. And so even if you call this lesser, it's still there and it still hurts when they attack.
Okay, about your book, your latest book anyway, Muhammad, A Critical Biography. You've written other books about Muhammad, like Did Muhammad Exist? And The Truth About Muhammad. How is this one different?
Yeah, you know, it grows out of Did Muhammad Exist? And The Truth About Muhammad. The Truth About Muhammad was first, and I wrote that to try to introduce people. This was just a few years after 9/11, and I wanted to introduce people to the teachings of Muhammad because there were so many lies floating around. You may remember the Islamic apologist Karen Armstrong. She was an ex-nun and a historian, got a lot of media coverage. Her books were massive bestsellers, and she actually compared Muhammad to Gandhi. And that is just so ridiculous that I thought what we need is a real biography of Muhammad to show what the Islamic texts actually do say about him. And so that's The Truth About Muhammad. But the historical reliability of those texts, if you're trying to figure out, well, what did Muhammad really say and do? It's very slight, because most of the texts that we have about Muhammad's life are a couple of hundred years after the life of Muhammad is supposed to have been. So I wrote Did Muhammad Exist to explore some of the historical difficulties behind taking those texts as historically reliable, as most people do to this day. You have the 19th century French historian Ernest Renan, and he said that Muhammad he lived in the full light of history. And so this is, I think, actually, you know, when I studied Islam in graduate school way back decades ago, it was just taken for granted that these stories were historically reliable. Nobody even questioned that. And I think that's still the mainstream view. So I wanted to show in Did Muhammad Exist, what was the difficulty with doing that and why there are really serious doubts about whether any of these stories have any historical value at all. So Muhammad, A Critical Biography, the new book, it takes all that and goes farther. I go through the Islamic traditions about Muhammad and show how they are full of contradictions and full of strange anomalies that show that we're not dealing with historical accounts, and that the idea that this is sober history is contradicted on a number of fronts. So it's a biography. It'll tell you what Islamic tradition says Muhammad said and did, but it also compares the most well-known stories with lesser-known variants from Islamic tradition as well, to show that the figure of Muhammad that we take for granted today is really cobbled together out of a lot of contradictory material. And there isn't any clear Muhammad even in Islamic literature.
So I guess to some extent, you can compare this to the legend of King Arthur, where there may or may not be a kernel of historical truth or fact to the existence of King Arthur, but layers upon layers of myth and history have been overlaid on that possible historical reality. Could you say the same thing about Muhammad?
Yeah, absolutely. There may have been a figure named Muhammad, although actually I think that in itself is doubtful. But even if there were, we can't know for certain that he did any of the things that are attributed to him as having done in the Islamic traditions. The Islamic traditions basically have no value historically. And if there was a Muhammad, all these legends and myths were overlaid upon essentially the bare name or the idea that there was a warrior prophet, and all the rest of it is as fictional as the stories of King Arthur.
Now, I'm sure that people who haven't heard this argument before from you are surely reeling from it, thinking, now, come on, Muhammad is one of the most influential figures in history. How is it possible that he might not even have existed?
Well, yeah, it does seem when people first hear this, they think this is crazy. As a matter of fact, that's what I thought when I first heard it. I remember having a long conversation with the great Islamic scholar and ex-Muslim Ibn Warraq. And he was explaining this to me. And I thought, this is inconceivable. How could this possibly be? But the more I looked into it, the more I realized that he was right. The first thing is, take, for example, the silence of 60 years. If you compare the beginnings of Christianity with the beginnings of Islam, Jesus lived in the early 30s of the first century. By the 90s of the first century, 60 years later, you have the New Testament, you have churches all over the Mediterranean world, you have the post-apostolic, some of the post-apostolic writings, you have some non-Christians talking about Christianity. Now, Muhammad, coincidentally, lived about exactly 600 years later. I mean, he was born much earlier because he lived longer, but he died in, he's supposed to have died in 632. And so if you take the period, the same 60-year period from the 630s to the 690s, you have the Arabs pouring out of Arabia and conquering the Middle East, North Africa, Persia, and part of India. You have this massive empire. And so you would expect that we would have plenty of record of Muslims explaining to the conquered people, we're coming to you, we're doing this because the prophet that of our new religion said that we should go out and fight those who are unbelievers, and we're going to keep on fighting you, and we're going to subjugate you under the rule of our new laws in our new religion, and here's our new holy book, the Quran, and so on and so on. And you find nothing like that. You find a few scattered mentions of Muhammad, but none of them correspond to the stories about Muhammad that we have that come later. And you have a lot of literature from the people who were conquered, and none of them give any hint that the conquerors had a new religion, a new prophet, or a new holy book. So it's a kind of an amazing absence, really, that in all that, you would expect them to be talking incessantly about Muhammad and Islam, and there's glaringly absent.
Well, okay, and then how and when then does the creation of the Quran itself figure into this? Because probably the most essential article of faith in Islam is that the Quran represents the literal word of Allah as dictated to his prophet Muhammad. So if there's no evidence for the historical Muhammad, or if everything we know has been massively embellished, does Islam itself begin to unravel?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. If you look at the historical record of the Quran, it's the same kind of oddity. The traditional story, the standard story, if you went to a madrasa today, if you went to a mosque today and said, teach me about Islam and tell me, where did you get this Quran? They would say, well, Muhammad got the Quran over 23 years, from 610 to 632 when he died. And he got, he got portions of it on different occasions when he was visited by the angel Gabriel, who transmitted it to him. Okay, so by 632 then, the Quran was finished, but nobody had the whole thing. It was scattered around. Some parts of it were written down, and much more of it was memorized. Different people had different portions memorized. Okay, so 20 years later, the Caliph Uthman in 653, he has the idea that, look, the early Muslims are starting to die off, and we're going to lose the Quran. So we better get it together and get it written down. So he called together everybody who had memorized parts of the Quran, and they recited every bit of it that they knew, and Zayd ibn Thabit, who was charged with taking this job and putting the Quran together, produced the Quran that we have now, and Uthman distributed it around the Islamic world as it was in that day. And that's the standard story. So if we had the Quran from 653, it's really weird, but nobody quotes it, and nobody even refers to its existence for another 40 years. And, you know, where is it? If you sent me a book today and said, I'd really like you to review this book, I'm likely to do it before the next 40 years are out. And it would seem like if people received the book that they thought was the perfect word of Allah, that would be exciting. That would be momentous to have. And they'd be out quoting it all over the place. But nothing. Then in the 690s, you have the construction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Temple Mount, and you have Quran inscriptions written on the walls. nowhere does it say these are Quran inscriptions, and they're all mixed up with stuff that's not the Quran, which in itself is kind of weird. Then a few 20-some years later, you have John of Damascus, who was the first Christian to write extensively about Islam. And he says, I've read your books. I've read the writing of the cow, the writing of the table, the writing of women. And those are actually the names of chapters of the Quran. But John refers to them as if they're separate books. And he also says, and I've read the writing of the camel of God, which is not one of the chapters of the Quran. And the obvious conclusion from that would be maybe John doesn't have the Quran as it's currently constituted. He has an earlier version. And there was another writer around the same time who said, I've read your Quran and I read Surah Al-Baqarah. Now, Surah Al-Baqarah is the second chapter of the Quran as it stands today. Now, Mark, have you ever read a book and said, yeah, I read that book, and I read chapter 3 in it, too? That doesn't make any sense. And so it suggests that the chapter that he's referring to, actually chapter 2 of the Quran, as it stands today, was not chapter 2 of the Quran at that time, but was a separate book, and they got put together later. So the whole thing is much more fluid and less certain than the Islamic spokesman nowadays would have us believe.
Okay, now I'm assuming that the vast, vast majority of the 1.8 billion Muslims in the world aren't even aware that the very existence of the most consequential figure at the roots of their belief is questionable. Is it possible that they would be open to considering the implications of this argument, your argument?
No, absolutely not. It's kind of a wild thing. I remember having a debate about this with Anjem Chowdhury, the famous imam in Britain, who is now in prison for trying to organize terrorist activities. And we were actually supposed to debate whether Muhammad existed. And his whole argument was summed up in one sentence. Of course Muhammad existed. He's mentioned in the Quran. Well, there you have it. And of course, most Muslims, when they hear about this as a possibility at all, they dismiss it as Islamophobia, as if just out of pure hate, me and the other people who write about these things are constructing this claim that Muhammad didn't exist. Now, this is something that leftist academics are susceptible to as well, because they're idiots, but because they also buy into this idea of victimhood and Islamophobia on the part of Muslims. So you have a lot of Western academics dismissing this as well. But then they turn around and engage in massive explorations of the historicity of Christ or of Moses, and they have no second thoughts about that. And, you know, I got no problem with that. I studied all that in college. I think that it's a perfectly reasonable line of academic inquiry. And so why should Muhammad be any different? Why should Muhammad be singled out for special treatment? And yet that's just one other thing. It's a funny thing. That is what happens all over, to the degree that I recently saw an online academic discussion of the historical problems of the Bible and the Quran. And for the to discuss the historical problems of the Bible, whoever was putting this on had Bart Ehrman, the famed academic who says that there's no historical value to the New Testament and it's all legends and fables and so on. And then on the other side was an Islamic apologist who was just going to tell us how reliable the Quran was. And I thought, well, that's academia today, right there.
Wafa Sultan, who is a former Muslim and a fierce critic of Islam, has said that if death weren't the penalty for apostasy in Islam, there would be a flood of people leaving the religion. Now, I know this is pure guesswork, but do you suspect that there are many Muslims who might secretly welcome the seed of doubt that your argument and your book would introduce?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, I heard from one not just a few days ago, who asked me to send him an autographed copy of Muhammad, A Critical Biography, and I sent it out a couple days ago. I hope he'll get it soon. In his email asking for this, he told me that it was because of the explorations of the existence of Muhammad that he ended up leaving Islam. And there are certainly many secret apostates in the Islamic world. This is beyond dispute. Because of the death penalty for apostasy, they don't dare to let it be known that they've left Islam, but nonetheless they have, and they are very happy to see intellectual explorations of why Islam is false. And so that's a very positive sign in terms of the overall prognosis of whether the West is going to die first or the Islamic world, and which chaos we'll be enveloped in, or whether we can escape it altogether. That's at least one positive sign.
What's the reception been for this book, Muhammad, A Critical Biography? Have your negative critics blown a gasket denouncing this blasphemous work, or do they simply try to ignore you so as not to draw attention to the book? I mean, is anybody willing to debate you on this? Because I know there's a long-standing pattern of challengers huffing and puffing about debating you, but then they back out for whatever reason. Usually it's something like, oh, Spencer's just an Islamophobe who's not worth my time. But if you were so easily dismissed, why wouldn't they jump at the chance to humiliate you in a debate?
Well, exactly. And there isn't any Islamic spokesman, as far as I know. If there is one who hears this, contact me at director@jihadwatch.org and we'll set it up. But as far as I know, there's no Islamic spokesman who is willing to debate this. There are some who want to debate aspects of Christianity or this and that. And I don't have any interest in doing that. They are, in the first place, notoriously dishonest debaters, and they'll tell 10 lies, and then you only have time to refute 5, and it's mostly a pointless exercise. But they generally want to stay away from this issue. It's something that I think that they have not worked out a response to yet, except just to wave it away as saying it's Islamophobic to say such a thing or suggest such a thing, and that's it. And as that flies less and less, they're going to have to think of some other way to deal with this, but they haven't yet.
Well, I think it's an amazing, important book, and it deserves all of the promotion it can possibly get. But now for something completely different, as Monty Python used to say. I want to put in a plug for what I think, if I remember correctly, is your previous book, Empire of God. Because I love history, especially medieval history, and the Byzantine Empire, I think, is often overlooked by people, but you've put together this really impressive, relentlessly readable work of scholarship about the Byzantine Empire, and I don't want to give it short shrift or give away any spoilers, but could you give us the thumbnail version or maybe a teaser of how the Byzantines saved civilization?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you liking that book. I liked it myself, and anyway, you know, seriously, as with, I'm sure, everyone who's written more than one book, you like some more than others. And I like that one very much. So I appreciate it. In any case, the Empire of God, how the Byzantines saved civilization is overall, it's a history of the Roman Empire in its Byzantine period, or the Byzantine Empire, or Eastern Roman Empire, as it's generally known. Not many people know much about that part of history at all. I show that the Byzantines saved civilization in a number of ways. One of the foremost was in preserving the intellectual achievements of classical Greek civilization. Now, what's noteworthy about that is that that's something that is often attributed to the Islamic world. You will find many, many people saying that Muslims translated the great works of Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, and so on into Arabic. And then they were translated out of Arabic into Latin much later and spread around Western Europe. And thus it is to the Muslim Arabs that we owe the survival of classical Greek civilization when the benighted, racist, ignorant Christians of Western Europe were rejecting that learning as pagan and having nothing to do with their Christian purity. This is all just a lot of nonsense and historical myth. What really happened was this. Constantinople, now Istanbul, of course, the capital of the Roman Empire from 330 on to 1453, when it finally was conquered by the jihadis, was a center of culture and learning unparalleled in the world at that time. And they did preserve the teachings of the classical Greeks. And not only was the Roman Empire in its Byzantine period Christian, but it was not benighted and racist and bigoted and prejudiced. And they taught those classics, even though they were non-Christian, they were pre-Christian writings. They continued to teach in the classics of Greek civilization in their schools all the way through the life of the empire. Meanwhile, in Western Europe, there was a lot of political strife and a corresponding decline in the level of civilization. And a lot of the Greek classics were not preserved in the days when books had to be preserved by being painstakingly copied out by hand. And as Greek receded in Western Europe and Latin was the ascendant language, only a couple of works of Plato were translated into Latin and available in Western Europe. Now, what happened was, in 1439, there was an attempt to reunite the Eastern and Western churches, or what are known today as the Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox churches, and there was a council held in Florence in Italy to try to do this. And the emperor went, and the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, they both went to Florence, and they went with a retinue of other bishops and theologians and so on to discuss the issues that kept the two churches apart. And also going along, I believe he was the emperor's friend, if I recall correctly, was a Neoplatonist philosopher named Gemistos Plathon. And the emperor asked him to go along as his friend and companion. And so he went, but he was not a theologian and he was bored, frankly, with the proceedings of the council. So he was there in Italy with nothing to do. He started to give lectures to the Italians about Plato. And he would use books of Plato that were unknown in the Western world. And the Italians were amazed and they started to go in large numbers to Gemistos' lectures. And this was the beginning of the Renaissance because the books that he brought with him were copied, were translated, and started to spread all around Western Europe, sparking the interest in the classical world that led to the Renaissance. Also, not long after that, Constantinople fell to the jihadis, as I said, in 1453, and all kinds of scholars went west instead of continuing to live in Constantinople. And that also was a big boost for the Renaissance. So when you're talking about the preservation of classical civilization, which I think probably many people in America don't know today, but it was actually the basis for the founding of the American Republic and the idea of representative government and so many things that are core elements of our own system, that all comes from the scholars in Constantinople and spread from there to Western Europe. So that's how the Byzantines saved civilization. That's one way. There are other ways.
It's a very enlightening and very readable book. The title, again, is Empire of God: How the Byzantines Saved Civilization. I loved it, but I could also tell that it was a labor of love on your part too. But let's move away from your books and talk about what's happening in this brave new world of ours. Is there any one current issue, I'll let you choose, that you feel most personally invested in or compelled to warn people about or enlighten them about? What's a message, in other words, that you most would want to get out to people about current events?
Well, I think it's summed up by David Horowitz saying that's at the heading of Front Page Mag online. The inside every progressive is a totalitarian screaming to get out. I think that we just had this election and we really dodged a bullet. And the thing we should remember is that the struggle is not over. These people have not given up and we're going to hear more from them and it's not going to be good. But the big issue that I think that people don't realize is that these people are not lovers of freedom. They are not fellow Americans who have a patriotic loyalty to the idea of a free republic and a loyal opposition. These people really are totalitarians. They really want to silence and crush dissent, and that's us. The Biden administration tried to set up a disinformation governance board that would have crushed the freedom of speech. They worked with the social media giants to silence dissidents from their COVID program because they are totalitarians who hate the freedom of speech. They worked in numerous other ways to limit and destroy the freedom of speech, and they're still at it. They haven't given up. And without the freedom of speech, we have no freedom in society. So we should be on our guard and aware that this is a struggle that is still very much happening. And we should be resolute and determined to defend the freedom of speech wherever and whenever it's attacked.
Well said. And you've kind of anticipated my next question, which is that in the wake of the red wave this past election, do you sense that not only has the political balance shifted, but the cultural momentum is suddenly reversing as well? Because I feel that, and I had always assumed that to reclaim the culture, conservatives were going to have to undertake a long march through the institutions of our own. But it feels like the left's cultural stranglehold is slipping almost overnight. I know it won't be that easy, and I don't want to sound complacent at all, but it feels like the left has been so rocked on its heels by this Trump landslide that they're just crumbling. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a long march through the institutions is still very much needed. But at the same time, the left, as they always do, they overplayed their hand. And they started to go so far that even people on the left who were still sane and reasonable started to think, wait a minute, you know, and forcing on people that they had to pretend that mentally ill men were women, and putting drag queens in primary schools and all this business, it was just too much for a lot of people who still would identify themselves as Democrats and on the political left. And so without the long march through the institutions, the left's cultural hegemony began to implode because of the left finding it too much. At least some of the more rational elements on the left.
I'm assuming that you're working on a new book, or there's maybe one already in the pipeline. Can you tell us about that, if there is?
There are actually two in the pipeline. And one is called Anti-Semitism, History and Myth, which is out in March. It's all ready. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. And it's a response to all the explosion of anti-Semitism that we have seen since October 7th, 2023. The first part of it is a study of the sources of anti-Semitism in pre-Christian paganism, in Christianity, in Islam, in National Socialism, and in International Socialism. And then the myth part is all the crazy stories that circulate increasingly nowadays about how the Jews control the media and the Jews faked the Holocaust and this and that. And I try to debunk as many of those as I can. And so it's designed to be a comprehensive handbook of responses to what is being claimed about the Jews today. And I hope that it does some good and staves off some of the really dark things that look like they're looming in the future. And then coming probably about a year from now, or I hope a little less, is another book that is all finished, but it's in the production process now. And that's called The Tragedy of Islam, Failure and Excuses. And it's about how Islam is bad for you. Islam is bad for individuals and for societies. And so I show that a lot of converts to Islam have turned to terrorism and why that's no accident. And that on a societal level, Islam creates poverty and resentment and hatred in civilizations. And then the rest of the book is how there are so many well-meaning Western non-Muslims who see all that, and instead of admitting it and adjusting their policies accordingly, they make excuses and claim that Islam had this mythical, glorious past and a golden age and so on. And so I show how all that is fiction and wishful thinking. And so that should be out, I hope, in about 9 or 10 months.
Wow. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to both of those books. Robert, apart from checking out your work on Front Page Mag and jihadwatch.org, where should people go to keep up with what you are doing?
JihadWatchRS on Twitter. And also I write at pjmedia.com.
Well, good to know. Robert Spencer, thanks so much for coming to The Right Take. It was a long overdue conversation. And thank you, sir, for all you do in defense of freedom.
Mark, it's a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Listeners, pick up a copy of Muhammad, A Critical Biography, and everything else Robert writes, wherever fine books are sold. And thank you, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you can keep up with all the important conversations we are having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.